Chapter 3. As a place to sleep in, it was rather small, but it would make a spacious bathroom. It wasn't for him to ask why Mrs. Ripple should wish to sacrifice her third bedroom in order to have a second bathroom, though he tended to wonder about these things. In other people's homes, as he so often was these days, Philip found himself speculating about all sorts of oddities and incongruities. Why, for instance, did she keep a pair of binoculars on the windowsill in here? To watch birds? To observe the behaviour of neighbours? The dressing table was very low, and there was no stool. If a woman wanted to do her hair or put makeup on in front of the mirror, she would have to sit on the floor. In the small bookcase were nothing but cookery books. Why didn't she keep her cookery books in the kitchen? He took his tape measure from his pocket and began measuring the room. 4 meters 30 by 3 meters 15, and the ceiling height 2 meters 52. He wouldn't be doing the design himself. He hadn't progressed so far yet. In any case, there'd be nothing inspired or ambitious about it. Champagne bath and basin she had chosen, a vanity unit with black marble top and milk-coloured tiles with a black and gold floral pattern. The window was to be double-glazed. He took his measurements with concentrated care. Roy would want to know widths and lengths to the nearest millimetre. The figures written down in his neat small hand in the Rosebery Lawn Interiors notebook, Philip leant on the windowsill and looked outside. A collage of gardens lay below him, all the same size, each one separated from its neighbours by fencing with trellis on it. It was the most beautiful time of the year, and the ornamental trees were in fresh new leaf, many of them in blossom, pink or white. Tulips were in bloom. These were among the few flowers he knew by name. The velvety brown and gold things which filled the end of Mrs. Ripple's garden he thought might be wallflowers. Beyond the gardens, which backed onto those on this side, was a row of houses, their rear aspects facing him. No doubt they'd started off all the same, but various additions, a loft made into a bedroom, a conservatory built on, an extra garage, now differentiated them, and made each an individual. Only one seemed still as the builder had built it, but it had the best garden, with a pink may tree halfway down where the lawn was broken into by a rock garden. Over this spilled and sprawled a carpet of purple and yellow alpine plants. Surveying this tumbled spread of flowers, sheltered to some extent by the branches of the tree with its rose-coloured blossom, stood a small statue in marble. Philip couldn't see it very clearly, it was too far away, but something in its attitude seemed familiar. The angle of its slightly upraised face, the outstretched right hand holding a bunch of flowers, the feet that, though planted firmly on the ground, yet seemed to be dancing. He wished very much that he could get a closer look at it. Then he realized that he could. The binoculars were here on the windowsill. He took them out of their case and raised them to his eyes. A certain amount of adjustment was needed before he could see clearly, and then, suddenly, the vision they afforded him was amazing. They were excellent glasses. He could see the little statue as if it were no more than a metre away from him. He could see her eyes and her lovely mouth, and the waves in her hair, the diagonal weave in the fillet which bound it, the almond curves of her fingernails, and the details of the flowers, their stamens and petals, in the sheaf she carried. And he could see, too, the green stain that travelled from the side of her neck to where her robe covered her breasts, and the tiny chip out of her left earlobe. He had made that chip himself when he was 10, and a stone fired from his catapult had clipped the side of her head. His father had been angry, taken away the catapult and docked his pocket money for 3 weeks. It was Flora. Not a look-alike or a copy, but Flora herself. As Fee had pointed out, she wasn't one of those mass-produced plaster ornaments to be seen in their dozens at every motorway junction garden centre. She was unique. He remembered rather incongruously what Cheryl had said of her while talking to Arnhem about their father. She was the Farnese Flora who was traditionally associated with May Blossom. Philip replaced the binoculars in their case, put away his measure and his notebook, and went downstairs. Some clients you had to search for, cough, knock on doors to summon them. Mrs. Ripple wasn't of that sort, but alert, spry, hawk-eyed. She was a middle-aged woman of great spirit and vigour, very sharp-tongued, and, he suspected, critical. She had a shiny, sore-looking face, and a lot of dark hair with threads of grey in it, like fusoir. "I'll be in touch when the layout is completed," he said to her, "and then you'll see me again when work commences." It was the way they were taught to speak to customers at Rosebery Lawn. Philip had never actually heard a human being snort, but that was the kind of sound Mrs. Ripple made. "When's that going to be?" she said. "Sometime next year?" There had been a delay about sending her their brochures, Roy said, adding that he didn't think she was likely to forget it. Philip assured her, with as radiant a smile as he could manage, that he hoped it would be no more than 4 weeks at the outside. She said nothing in reply, left him to open the front door and close it after him. Philip got into his car, a three-month-old blue Opel Kadett, thinking, as he sometimes did, that it was the only nice thing he possessed. And he didn't really possess it. It belonged to Rosebery Lawn. Instead of driving back the way he'd come, he took the first left-hand turning and then turned left again. This brought him out into the street where the row of houses, whose rears the back of Mrs. Ripple's faced, must be. They looked very different from this aspect. He hadn't counted precisely where in the row the house with the statue in its garden came, but he knew it must be fourth or fifth from the block of flats with green pantile roof. It was also the only one without additions. And here it was. This must be it. Between the house with the window in its roof and the house with two garages. Philip drove past slowly. It was gone five. His day was over, so he wasn't wasting the firm's time, something he was still conscientious about. At the end of the road, at a T-junction, he turned round and drove back. Opposite the house, he parked the car by the curb and switched off the engine. The front garden was small, with a rose bed, in which the roses were not yet out. Three steps led up to one of those Georgian front doors with a sunburst fanlight. A feature of the house, Philip was sure it would be called a feature, was a small circular stained-glass window a little way above the front door. Through one of the panes of clear glass in that window, a lozenge shape in the pretentious coat of arms which formed the design, a woman's face could be seen looking out. She wasn't looking at Philip, who in any case was invisible inside his car. She moved away, and he was about to start the engine when her face appeared, and the upper part of her body, at a casement of leaded lights which she opened. She wasn't all that young by his standards, but still he could see she was young. The afternoon sun shone full on her face, and it was handsome in a bold, aggressive sort of way, the mass of dark, frizzy hair springing back from a broad, white brow. She was a good distance from him, but he saw the sun catch and flash fire from a diamond on her left hand, and that told him she was Gerard Arnhem's wife. Arnhem had married, and this was whom he had married. Anger bubbled up in Philip the way blood bubbles up through a sharp cut in skin. Like that blood flow, he couldn't immediately control it. There was no cold tap to hold his rage under, and he cursed silently in the closed car. Philip's anger made his hands tremble on the wheel. He wished he hadn't come. He wished he had driven back from Mrs. Ripple's the way he'd come, through Hainault and Barkingside. If things had gone differently, his mother might have been living there, surveying the street from that stained-glass shield, opening that casement to feel the sun. He couldn't meet Christine's eyes. He was uneasy when he was alone with her. Sometimes he could hardly frame the words of some simple routine sentence. Something about the dog, or had she paid this or that bill. This was the first time he'd experienced a mental preoccupation which had become obsessive. In the past there'd been his grief at his father's death. He'd worried a bit about exams, then been in suspense while waiting to hear if he was to be offered a place in the Rosebery Lawn training scheme. Another cause for anxiety had been his doubt that permanent employment would follow when his training was complete. But none of those invasions of his equilibrium had overwhelmed his waking thoughts as this knowledge did. It frightened him, too, because he couldn't understand what was happening to him. Why did he care so much that his mother had slept with a man? He knew she'd slept with his father. He knew that if she'd married Arnhem, they would have slept together. Why did he have to think about it so much, torment himself with pictures of the two of them together, repeat in his mind over and over Fee's words, Fee's awful revelations? The postcard was still on the living room mantelpiece. He had never carried out his threat of throwing it away, and it was always the first thing he saw when he went into the room. It was as if, instead of a small piece of card with a commonplace photograph on it, it had become a huge picture in violent oils depicting some scene of sadism and sexual depravity, the kind of thing you don't want to look at, but which compels your eyes and stretches them from their sockets. Somehow their roles had been reversed. He had become her father, and she his child. He was the father who wants revenge on his daughter's seducer, or for her seducer to marry her. Pity for her wrenched at him when he looked at her sitting there quietly, stitching away at Cheryl's bridesmaid's dress. If she'd gone alone to Arnhem's house that day they took Flora, Would she be Mrs. Arnhem now? Philip couldn't help thinking that the arrival of all of them on that autumn evening, instead of Christine on her own, had been a decisive factor in Arnhem's marriage plans. The other woman, the one with the dark hair and the diamond ring, might also have been a candidate at that time, and he had chosen her because she wasn't accompanied by a bevy of children and a marble statue. She asked him if he minded her putting the television on. She always asked. He tried to remember if she'd done that while his father was alive, and he didn't think she had. One of the items on the 9 o'clock news was a sighting of Rebecca Neve by someone in Spain. It was nearly 8 months since her disappearance, but reminders of her came into the papers and on television from time to time. A man who sounded responsible and honest claimed to have seen her in her green velvet tracksuit in a resort on the Costa del Sol. It was a place where, according to her parents, Rebecca had twice spent holidays. The man had probably imagined it, Philip thought, or was one of those who will say and do anything to get publicity. He hadn't meant to return to Mrs. Ripple's house, had felt strongly that Chigwell was a corner of the outskirts of London he would be happy never to see again. But in the middle of the week, before Fee's wedding, Roy, who was designing the new bathroom, came up with a problem about the tiling. He needed Mrs. Ripple's consent to certain changes he proposed in the design, as well as further wall measurements, notably distances between window frames and door architraves, and the ends of walls. Philip found himself saying that he could make a very good guess at those measurements, and the householder's consent could be obtained by phone. "That's the sort of reply I expect of certain other newly graduated trainees," said Roy, "but not of you." His hard, dark eyes swam behind the thick glasses he wore. When he wasn't making cynical, unfunny jokes, Roy talked like a brochure. "It's thoroughness and attention to the smallest detail which has established Rosebery Lawn's distinguished reputation." Philip realized there was no escape from going to Chigwell, but he told himself that he need not drive along the street where Arnhem lived, or even come to that, take a second look at Flora through the binoculars in Mrs. Ripple's back bedroom. When he left home, Christine's first client of the day had already arrived, a woman who was having copper-coloured lowlights put into her hair. For once, Philip was glad his mother wouldn't be carrying out this project in the bathroom. As it was, he would come home to find the kitchen floor covered with orange splash marks. "I want to make enough money to pay for Fee's flowers myself," Christine whispered as she saw him off at the front door. She pulled on the rubber gloves that were to keep her hands stain-free for Saturday, and stuck her thumbnail through the left-hand one. Customers of Rosebery Lawn often behaved as if visits from employees of the company they'd engaged to renovate their homes were a gross intrusion of privacy. Philip had been told of one householder who had taped up the doors on the kitchen he was having converted, and obliged the fitters to climb in and out through the window. It was commonplace to be refused the use of lavatory or phone. Mrs. Ripple, alerted to his coming, though not by him, opened her front door with alacrity. It was as if she'd been waiting just inside it. He had scarcely set foot inside the hall when she said to him in a savage tone, "What right do you think you had to use my husband's field glasses?" Philip was briefly dumbstruck. Had she tested them for fingerprints? Had some neighbour reported seeing them in his hands? "Caught you there, haven't I?" she said. "You thought you got away with that one." Philip said he was sorry. What else could he say? "I expect you're wondering how I find you out." This was uttered the reverse of roguishly, Mrs. Ripple's thick brown eyebrows drawing together like a pair of furry caterpillars meeting, but Philip nevertheless hazarded a smile. "I placed them on that windowsill just so," she said, "in the corner and with the long side precisely parallel to the wall." The caterpillars leapt apart and sprang towards her hairline. "I've my own reasons for doing that, which I shan't go into, but that's how I knew. They'd been replaced out of alignment." "I won't touch them," Philip said, making for the stairs. "You won't get the chance." She had removed the binoculars. Philip felt quite shaken by this encounter. Like most people, he was frightened by madness, even when manifested in its milder forms. Did she perhaps suspect her husband of using the glasses to watch women undressing or something like that? And if so, what good did having her suspicions repeatedly proved sound do her? At least temptation had been removed from him. He wouldn't be able to take a close look at Flora without them. The guesses he had made at the measurements were so nearly accurate as to confirm his opinion that he was wasting time coming here. But denied the use of the binoculars, he perversely found himself longing to look at Flora again. He opened the window and leant out. The May tree had bloomed and shed most of its blossoms. The grass and paving stones were pink with fallen petals, the purple rock garden sprinkled with pink as if covered by a rosy veil. Petals lay on Flora's shoulders and on her outstretched arm, and the flowers she carried were no longer stone, but a bouquet of May. But she seemed very far away from him. The distance rendered her features and the details of sculpture invisible. He retreated, closing the window, wondering as he did so if Mrs. Ripple had placed a hair across the catch. Perhaps she would come up after he'd gone and sprinkle the window frame with fingerprint powder. Then woe betide him when he came to inspect the work in progress, as he might easily have to do. She was waiting for him at the foot of the stairs. She said nothing, and her silence and long, cold basilisk stare had the effect of making him speak in a nervous, hearty way. "Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Ripple, that's done. You'll be hearing from us in due course. We'll keep you up to date with progress." He passed her, left her behind his line of vision, felt her eyes following him. Halfway down the path he saw Arnhem's car go by. Not the Jaguar, but a second car. He would have a second car. The Jaguar probably belonged to his company, the way the cadet belonged to Rosebery Lawn. The woman in the passenger seat, the near side which was nearest to him, was the woman he had seen at the window. It was a warm day and the car window was open on her side. Her arm rested along the rim of the glass panel. On the hand was the diamond ring, and on the wrist the diamond watch. Arnhem he could see only as a dark, heavy silhouette. The direction they were going in was away from their house. It was this which made up Philip's mind for him, if his mind could be said to be made up, if his mind entered into it. The cadet even seemed to drive itself. Caution and reason returned sufficiently to make him park it a little way down the road. There was no one about. There never was in suburbs in the afternoons. Philip could remember his father telling him of the time when he was a child, and there had been people about in streets like this one, quite a lot of them, people on foot because cars were few. These houses might have been uninhabited, their garages closed, their front gardens empty. All down the road, the green of foliage and grass, the whiteness of buildings, was patched with laburnums in full bloom, a pure glistening yellow. The sun shone onto stillness and silence. Philip went into Arnhem's garden by the gates to the garage drive, and made his way to the wooden door that evidently led to a passageway between garage and house. If it was locked, that would be the end of the enterprise. But it wasn't locked. Once inside, in a narrow defile with brick walls on either side, he realized he'd brought neither container nor covering with him. And he knew that if he went back to the car to find something suitable, he'd never return. He would give up and drive away. At the end of the passage was a yard or terrace of concrete slabs. A very commonplace coal bunker on one side, a pair of dustbins on the other. Arnhem had changed the Buckhurst Hill house for something distinctly inferior. Of course, he had had to divide the sale price with his former wife. Protruding over the rim of one of the dustbins was a blue plastic bag, provided no doubt by the local authority's refuse collection service. Philip helped himself to that bag. He crossed the lawn to where she was. Close to, the fallen May blossom on her shoulders and the crown of her head gave her a neglected look. He brushed them off, lightly blew away a petal from her ear, the same ear that once, long ago, he had chipped with a stone from his catapult. Squatting down close in front of her, he observed, as he had never quite done before, the remoteness of her gaze, the way her eyes seemed to stare past those who looked at her, to fix themselves on some distant and perhaps glorious horizon. Of course she was a goddess. She was above earthly things and human needs. His thoughts surprised him. They were as fanciful as if he were dreaming, or in a fever. This was the way he had thought and imagined things while in the throes of that bad bout of flu he had had in the winter. But why on earth had Arnhem told Christine Flora looked like her? Or had that perhaps been wishful thinking on her part? She looked like no real woman Philip had ever seen, though he thought quite suddenly, and rather madly, that if he ever saw a real woman with that face, he would at once fall in love with her. He reached for Flora and lifted her up. Some of the pink petals fell off the bunch of marble flowers. She seemed even heavier than when he had carried her up the hill from Buckhurst Hill Station. He drew the blue plastic bag over her head, laid her on the grass, and tied a knot in the top of the bag. Carrying the bundle in his arms, he might have been holding a length of piping or some garden tool. It was when he was halfway across the grass towards the passageway and the wooden door that he saw he was watched. A man in a window next door was watching him. Philip told himself he was doing nothing wrong. Flora didn't belong to Gerard Arnhem, or rather, he thought somewhat obscurely, she might have belonged to him if Arnhem had done the right thing by Christine. loved her and married her, but she certainly didn't in the present circumstances. Arnhem, by his behaviour, had forfeited the right to own her. Philip had read somewhere that if you borrow an object and hold on to it, the only person who has a right to take it from you is the true owner. That was the law. Well, he was the true owner. Flora had been lent to Arnhem. She was his conditionally only on his marrying Christine. That surely was an understood thing. Nevertheless, he quickened his pace. In spite of the weight of her, he ran down the path to the garage gates. His arms full, it took him a moment or two to get them open. A voice behind him from the other side of the fence said, "I say, excuse me, what exactly do you think you're doing with that?" The words were very similar to Mrs. Ripple's. Philip didn't even turn his head to take a look at the inquirer. He ran. Gasping because Flora was so heavy, he ran down the street to where his car was parked. He heaved her into the back seat and struggled into his safety belt. The man hadn't followed him. Philip was certain he had done the more sensible thing and gone back into the house to phone the police. He saw his job lost, a conviction recorded against him for a criminal offence. But be reasonable, keep your head. The man hadn't seen his car, hadn't taken a note of the number. Philip's hands shook on the wheel, but he made a mammoth effort and steadied them. He began to drive, took the left-hand turn, then a right. There was no one behind him and no one ahead. Out on the big road, heading for Barkingside, he heard the siren of a police car. But why assume it was for him? That it had anything to do with him? A police car with a howling siren wouldn't turn out because a man had been seen coming out of a garden with something in a plastic bag. They'd be more likely to send an officer round on a bike. Perhaps because his mother was so helpless and his sisters often liable to irrational fears, Philip had grown up a cool-headed person. He was like his father, who had been a practical man. And though endowed with plenty of imagination, he'd learnt to keep it in check. Therefore, he didn't let himself become a prey to all kinds of unreal speculations. And by the time he reached Gans Hill and the big roundabout on the A12, he was quite calm again. Flora had bounced about a bit on the back seat. When he reached the Ilford showroom, where he was due to call on his way back to the office, he transferred Flora from the back of the car to the boot, wedging her comfortably between the spare wheel and a cardboard crate of wallpaper sample books he was carrying with him. There in the car park, at the back of the showroom, he was unable to prevent himself taking a look at her. He pierced the plastic with the tip of his pen, his fingernails having failed to do it, and made a split long enough to reveal her face. She still gazed into Olympian distances, still maintained that grave but serene expression. Well, it would be something to get steamed up about if she didn't, thought Philip. Driving home rather later than usual, Roy had handed him a list of customers, some of them angry or indignant, to telephone and placate. Philip reflected on his act of the morning. Why had he taken the marble girl? Supposedly, because he felt she was rightly his, or his family's. It was as if Arnhem had perpetrated some kind of con trick in order to gain possession of her. People shouldn't be allowed to profit from their deceit. But having taken her, what was he going to do with her now? Well, not replace her in the garden at Glenallan Close. Too many explanations would be required if he were to do that. And there was Christine to consider. He would have to tell Christine where Arnhem now lived, and how he had seen Flora there. It was dangerous ground, this, an area he continuously shied away from. Could he perhaps say she wasn't Flora, but a Flora look-alike he had happened to see in a shop or garden centre, and had bought? Hopeless, with that chip out of her ear and that green stain. Even getting her into the house without being seen and questioned would be a problem. They weren't one of those families whose individual members led their own private secret lives, unnoticed by and of little interest to the others. They were a close-knit family, each concerned about the others, prepared to inquire into any oddity of behaviour, each knowing pretty well where the others were at any given time and what they were likely to be doing. He imagined himself encountering Cheryl on the stairs with his arms full of Flora and her amazement and her questions. As he thought that, while waiting in a queue of cars in the Edgware Road, watching the red light, he glanced to the right side of the street and saw Cheryl. Her name, and a kind of vague picture of her, had been in his mind, and then he saw her. She was coming out of what looked to him, he couldn't see very clearly, only a crowded, glittering conglomeration of colours and shapes, like a video shop or music centre. So much for always knowing where the others were and what they were doing. Cheryl was dressed in her customary jeans and black leather, and she had a cowgirl's hat on, broad-brimmed, steep-crowned, with a fringed leather band. There was no reason why she shouldn't be there. She was free. She wasn't doing anything she shouldn't be. or as far as he could see she wasn't. Philip had to drive on. He had to take his eyes from her as the lights went to red and amber, and a moment's delay would set the drivers behind him all braying on their horns. There was nothing to trouble him in her presence there, but in her appearance and stance there was. She had moved out of that doorway like a girl drugged or drunk, or exhausted or driven out against her will. The cause of her exit might have been any of those. And she was crying. The tears were running down her face. He saw her bow her head and put her fists in her eyes. And then he had to turn his eyes back to the road and put the car into gear and move fast away from her. Chapter 4. The five girls took up their pose against the drawn curtains at Christine's French windows. These curtains had come from her old home, and they were of rich dark brown velvet, lined and interlined, light excluding. The May sunshine showed itself only as a single thin bright line on the right-hand edge of the window, and this vanished when the photographer fastened the curtain to the window frame with a piece of scotch tape. Philip, a little uneasy in his moss-bross morning coat and striped trousers, first put his head round the door, then came in and stood at the opposite end of the room. The photographer's lights made it very hot. The photographer was an oldish man, his clothes reeking of cigarette smoke. At first the appearance of the girls dismayed Philip. He knew he had good taste, an eye for the stylish and elegant colour combinations. If he hadn't, he probably wouldn't have been in his present job, or have wanted it. Who had so badly advised Fee that she had got herself up in white satin, a bluish arctic white, stiff and gleaming as a sheet of ice? But perhaps it was all her own choice. Couldn't she see that this patrician dress with its high throat and lean arum lily sleeves, its narrow belled skirt, was designed for a tall, thin woman with a flat chest? Her hat was the sort of thing lead actresses wore in period films of the 40s. Philip had seen plenty of them on television. A kind of bowler, sported by ladies side-saddle on horseback. Only this one was white, with the wrong length of veil. And it was arum lilies she carried. Funeral flowers, he thought, remembering a wreath on his father's coffin. As to the bridesmaids, being commanded to smile now, to look not at the camera, but all adoringly at Fee, he would have laughed at their costumes. What other word for them was there, if he had seen them in a magazine? A kind of tunic, each in a different colour, rose, coral, lemon, apricot, great puffy sleeves of some net stuff with orange spots, and bursting from tunic hem at hip level, puff-balled skirts of the same spotty net. Pink and orange circlets of some unidentifiable flowers on their heads. They were grotesque. Well, he thought, surprising himself, they were all grotesque but one. Cheryl, Stephanie and Fee's old school friend Janice were absurd figures of fun, but the other one, she was different. She was... Words failed Philip as he stared at her. This must be Center. She didn't look as if connected with that family. She didn't look as if related to anyone of their sort. She was extraordinary. This wasn't in her height or something startling about the shape of her, for she was shorter than the other girls and very slender. Her skin was white, but not what people mean when they talk about white skin, or very fair or pale or creamy, but whiter than milk, white as the inner side of some deep seashell. Her lips were scarcely less pale. He couldn't tell the colour of her eyes, but her hair, which was very long, nearly waist length, straight and smooth, was silver. Not blonde, not grey, but silver, with here and there streaks of tarnish on it. But perhaps the most remarkable thing about her, to him, the most exciting thing, was her resemblance to Flora. Her face was Flora's, the perfect oval contour, the straight, rather long nose, which described an unbroken line from its tip to the top of her forehead, the widely separated calm eyes, the short upper lip, the lovely mouth that was neither full-lipped nor narrow. If that silver hair had been piled onto the back of her head and bound with ribbons, she would have been Flora's image. She carried herself with patient confidence. While the others fidgeted, patting their hair between camera shots, adjusting bra straps, recircling bouquets, Center stood as still as a statue. She was as calm and unruffled as the marble girl, thought Philip, whom 3 days before he had managed to sneak into the house and up the stairs while Christine finished off a trim in the kitchen. Her figure alone was not like Flora's, her body's bone structure delicate, her waist capable of being clasped in a pair of hands. Then, as the photographer commanded them all to look at the camera and smile for the last time, she turned fully to face him and gave him an unwelcome shock. Her smile was horribly forced and unnatural, a grimace, rather. It was almost as if she were deliberately mocking or sending up this whole rite. But surely she couldn't be. Surely that wasn't a purposely ugly, sneering grin. If it was, no one but he seemed to notice. The photographer called out, "Lovely, hold it, girls. This is positively the last one." The picture was taken, the record made. It would have its place, no doubt, along with the rest in Fee's wedding album. Now Fee only was left to pose for what the photographer called two exclusive portraits of the lovely bride. She had scarcely settled herself into position and allowed Stephanie to arrange the folds of her train when the door was pushed open and Hardy came in. "Oh, I must have one shot with him," Fee exclaimed. "Look at him, he's so sweet. He'll be quite all right to hold him. He's just been shampooed." Two of the bridesmaids had seated themselves on the settee, which was pushed back against the wall. But white-faced Center, her strange metallic hair now cloaking her shoulders, hesitated only for a moment and then walked slowly across the room to Philip. She walked as if she were a much taller woman, up straight, with her head held high, but at the same time very gracefully. Before she spoke to him, he looked at her mouth and thought it was the most beautiful mouth he had ever seen in a girl's face. What could the voice that came from that mouth be like? The lips parted. She spoke. "What a peculiar dog," she said. "He has orange spots. He looks like a mini Dalmatian." Philip said slowly, smiling at her, noticing something for the first time. "He matches your dresses." "Did you do it on purpose?" That made him laugh, her seriousness. What happened was my mother splashed him a bit while she was tinting someone's hair. It wouldn't come out when she washed him. "Oh, I thought he must be some rare breed." He'd expected a low voice, but hers was rather high-pitched. The vowels rounded and pure, the tone cool. She sounded as if she'd been taught to speak instead of picking speech up. He noticed that the hands which held her absurd Victorian posy of orange tulip heads and pink carnations were very small and blunt-nailed, like a child's. She had turned upon him almost colourless eyes, clear as water, in which a single drop of dye is spreading in streaks and whirls its dark greenness. "Are you Philip? Are you Fee's brother?" "That's right," he hesitated. "I'm got up in all this gear because I'm giving her away." She said, speaking very precisely, as if someone were writing her name down, "Senta Pelham." "I've never met anyone called Senta before. Sounds foreign." Her voice took on a cool edge. "Senta's the name of the girl in The Flying Dutchman." Philip wasn't sure what or who The Flying Dutchman was. Something musical, an opera? And he was glad of Christine's voice urgently calling his name. "Philip! Philip, where are you?" "Excuse me." She said nothing. He was unused to people who looked you straight in the eye without smiling. He closed the living room door behind him, found Christine in the kitchen, panicky, fraught with anxieties, but looking prettier than she had done for months. Her sudden resurgence of good looks embarrassed him, and he would have liked to close his eyes tightly. She was in blue, always her best colour, with a small round hat made of suede silk and peacock's feather turquoises and lavenders. "The car's here for me and your aunties, and the one for the bridesmaids. Well, that's all right, everyone's ready." She's nicer than Arnhem's wife, he thought. She's more of a woman, sweeter and gentler. And surprised himself by his thoughts. Her sisters came down the stairs. One mushroom hat, one parrot's wing, stilt heels, 20 denier nylons, every ring and bracelet and necklace to be found in their jewel boxes, accompanying clouds of tweed and Fiji. "You won't forget to shut Hardy up in the kitchen before you leave, will you?" Christine said to him. "Otherwise he'll go and do a wee-wee on the white rug. You know how he always does that when he's excited." He was alone with Fee. If only she had looked romantic, beautiful. There was nothing in her appearance to inspire a brother's emotion, to raise a lump in the throat, call forth memories of a shared childhood. Her face was creased up, petulant with a myriad small anxieties. She stood in front of a mirror, seeing, or imagining she saw, dots of mascara adhering to the skin under her left eye, rubbing with a finger whose cuticle she had bitten in stressful moments before the photographer turned up. "Don't forget to put your engagement ring on your other hand." She pulled it off impatiently. "Oh, I look awful, don't I?" "You look fine." "If it doesn't work out, we can get divorced. Most people do." I wouldn't get married if I thought like that. He didn't say it aloud. It seemed to him that he'd begun keeping everything from her, his views, opinions, feelings. She neither knew that Flora was upstairs in his wardrobe, nor that he had seen Cheryl come weeping out of a shop in the Edgware Road. Soon she would have someone else to confide in, tell her innermost thoughts to. But who would he have? She stepped back from the glass and turned to pick up her sheaf of arums from the table. But instead of doing this, she stopped in mid-act, as it were, and threw herself upon him and into his arms. Tense currents seemed to vibrate through her body. It was as if she were full of wires that thrilled with electricity. "Come on," he said, "come on, calm down." He held her in a hug that wasn't tight enough to crush the icy satin. "You've known him for years. He's the one for you." What else could he say? The original childhood sweethearts. He heard the car coming, the brakes. A door closed slickly, then footsteps on the front path. "Do you know what I keep thinking?" she said, disengaging herself, drawing herself up, smoothing her waistline. "I keep thinking if only that bloody Arnhem had done right by Mum, he could have been having a double wedding." He had made his speech, conscious while he brought out the stiff phrases of praise for Fee and Darren, of Senta Pelham's eyes resting on him. They seemed to rest there in a cold and speculative manner. Every time he looked in her direction, which was often, he found she was looking at him. He asked himself why this should be. Did he truly, as he feared, look ridiculous or unsightly in the grey morning coat, white shirt and silvery tie? It seemed to him, for all his fears, that the coat in fact fitted rather well. He knew, he couldn't help knowing, that he was good-looking and attractive to girls. Luckily, wherever that gene of shortness and dumpiness came from in his family, it had passed him and Cheryl by. He looked rather the way Paul McCartney had done when young. An old record sleeve of one of the Beatles' albums showed him his own face smiling. The party would break up soon. They only had St. Mary's Church Hall, an ancient hut smelling of stewed tea and hymn books, until 6. The guests, uncles and aunts and cousins, and school friends and workmates, past and present, would leave as soon as Fee and Darren had gone. Christine was talking to a rather good-looking middle-aged man, another of Darren's innumerable relatives. Giggling, behaving naturally for once, Cheryl stood eating wedding cake with two boys whose shoulder-length hair looked odd with their formal clothes. He accepted a piece of cake handed him by Stephanie, and, raising his eyes, met those of Senta, of Flora's double. They seemed to have darkened, the green staining that drifted through their watery depths having curiously intensified. Somewhere during the course of the afternoon she had shed the wreath of flowers which had encircled her head, and her hair, unconfined, hung in two gleaming curtains between which the soft, seductive features were enclosed. Her eyes widened as they held his, and, still gazing at him, she parted her lips and ran her tongue slowly and deliberately over the upper lip and then the lower. The lovely mouth was the pale pink of fruit blossom, but her tongue was red. He turned sharply away, convinced she was mocking him. Fee and Darren came back dressed as no one had ever seen them dressed before, each in a suit, his dark grey, hers white. It would be impossible for anyone they encountered on their journey tonight to an hotel, tomorrow to Guernsey, to mistake them for other than a honeymoon couple. This had been the first wedding Philip had been to since he was a child, and he was unprepared for the feeling of anticlimax he experienced as he got into the car. Once the bride and groom were gone, their trim suits smothered in confetti, their car decorated with slogans, and a tin can tied on behind, came an immediate sense of letdown. Everyone was going. The evening yawned emptily ahead. Christine would be spending it with one of her sisters. It was left to Philip to drive the bridesmaids back to Glenallan Close, where their everyday clothes were. All but Senta, who, standing by the bar in conversation with a man Philip didn't know, sent him a peremptory message by Janice that she would find her own way back to the house. She would get a lift. She would need to, Philip thought aggrievedly, for after the bright start to the day and sunny afternoon, a heavy rain had begun to fall. It made returning home and entering the empty house an even more gloomy business. The three girls went up to the room that Cheryl and Fee had shared, and now was Cheryl's alone, while Philip led Hardy out of the kitchen. He changed into jeans and a sweater, and as the rain seemed briefly to have lessened, took the little dog round the block, passing the departing Stephanie and Janice on his way back. Now was his chance to try and talk to Cheryl. She must still be upstairs. Halfway up he heard music coming from behind her closed door, and he went into his own room. He would give her 10 minutes or so. Philip's room was very small, too small to hold more than a single bed, a clothes cupboard, desk and narrow upright chair. And although he worked for a firm which specialised, among other things, in making the most of tiny box rooms like this one, with space-saving fitments and built-in furniture, he had never felt inspired to do something of that kind here. This was partly because he didn't want Glenallan Close improved. Make it more attractive, and Christine, and therefore himself, might be tempted to remain there forever. On the other hand, it would have been a different story if Christine was Mrs. Arnhem living in Chigwell, and this house had been made over to him. He would have smartened it up then, all right. He opened the clothes cupboard and lifted Flora out. She was still wrapped in the blue plastic bag, with a split in it for her face to show through. Philip untied the knot in the bag and pulled it off over her head. He stood her in the corner by the window. It was interesting that just having her there immediately improved the look of the room. Her white marble skin seemed to gleam in the grey, rain-filtered light. He wondered if it would be possible to remove the green stain which mantled her neck and breast. Her eyes looked beyond him, and her face seemed alight with pagan wisdom. Arnhem and his wife would have missed her as soon as they looked out into their garden. Probably the neighbour would have told them as soon as they returned about the thief he had seen carrying a log-shaped bundle, and they would have put two and two together. But Philip didn't think they would connect the removal of Flora with him. If Arnhem remembered him at all, it would be as he then was, a recent student, a newly recruited Rosebery Lawn trainee, who had presented a very different appearance from the man the neighbour would have described as short-haired and wearing a suit. Arnhem might even be relieved at the loss of Flora, while perhaps superstitiously unwilling to get rid of her himself. He was wondering whether to try working on that stain with paint-stripping fluid, or to talk to Cheryl first, when she spoke to him from outside on the landing. They never knocked at each other's doors, but they didn't walk into rooms uninvited either. "Phil, are you in there?" He hung his moss-bross clothes over the chair and pushed it in front of Flora to hide her. Opening the door, he found no one there. And then Cheryl came out of her room, dressed to go out in her usual uniform, the cowgirl hat in her hand. Her hair, done that morning in soft, loose curls, falling from a centre parting, bridesmaid's coiffure, looked incongruous with a heavy black eye makeup and the green star she had drawn on one cheekbone. "Will you do me a favour?" she said. The inevitable reply to that one. "Depends what it is." "Would you lend me £5? "Cheryl," he said, "I have to tell you I saw you in the Edgware Road on Wednesday. It was around 6 or 6:30. You were crying, and you were sort of staggering around." She stared at him, her underlip protruding. "I couldn't stop. I was stuck in the traffic. You looked like you were drunk. I've been thinking lately you might be on drugs. But you look more as if you were drunk." "I don't drink," she said. "Don't you notice anything about people? Couldn't you see I didn't even drink that fizzy stuff at the wedding? Glass of wine's enough to knock me sideways." She laid her hand on his arm. "Will you lend me £5? I'll give it back to you tomorrow." "It's not the money," he said. Of course, up to a point it was. He had very little spare cash. "It's not the money that's the trouble. But what do you mean I can have it back tomorrow? Tomorrow's Sunday. How are you going to get money on a Sunday?" She was gazing at him, her eyes glaring with a kind of desperate intensity. "Cheryl, how do you get money? Where does it come from?" "Oh, you sound like a policeman," she said. "Just like a policeman would question a person." He said unhappily, I think I've got a sort of right to ask you." "I don't. I'm over 18. I'm as much an adult as you are. I can vote." "Well, that's got nothing to do with it." "Please," she said. "Please, just lend me £5. You'll get it back tomorrow." "When you get your dole on Wednesday will do." He went back into his room and took the last £5 note he had from his wallet in the pocket of the moss-bross trousers. That left him with £3 coins and some odd pence. She snatched it from him. Once she held it crushed in her hand, up against the lapels of the leather jacket, she managed a smile. She managed a, "Thanks very much, Phil." He could find nothing to say to her. He went back into his room and sat down on the bed. Her feet went fast down the stairs, and he waited for the front door to slam. Instead, he heard her speaking to someone, a brief exchange of indecipherable words. Their mother, perhaps, had come back for something she'd forgotten. Forgetting things, money, keys, a coat, suitable shoes, was a commonplace with Christine. The door slammed rather less violently than usual. The house didn't shake from foundations to roof. He took the hired clothes off the chair, emptied the pockets, placed them on hangers and hung them inside the cupboard. The rain had begun again, buffeted against the glass by the rising wind. Someone knocked at the bedroom door. But no one in the household ever did. He thought, supposing it's the police sent after me for taking Flora, just suppose it is. A cold thrill went down his spine. But he didn't cover her up or put her away. He opened the door. It was Senta Pelham. He'd forgotten she was coming back. She was still in her bridesmaid's dress, and she was very wet. Her hair was wet, water dripping from it, and the spotted net, intended to be puffed and stiff, drooped like the petals of a rain-soaked flower. The coral satin clung to her thin, fragile-looking ribcage, and to the large round breasts, incongruously big for so slight a girl. Her nipples stuck out erect at the touch of the cold, wet stuff. "Is there a towel somewhere?" "In the bathroom," he said. "Didn't she know that? Hadn't she got herself up in that absurd garment in this house?" "I couldn't get a lift after all," she said, and he noticed she was out of breath. "I had to walk." Though it was more as if she'd been running. "Dressed like that?" She laughed in a throaty, gasping way. She seemed tremendously nervous. She went into the bathroom and came out, rubbing her hair dry with one bath towel and with another slung over her shoulder. Philip expected her to go into Cheryl's room, but instead she came into his and shut the door behind her. "There's a hairdryer somewhere." She shook her head, took off the towel and really shook it. The gleaming hair flew out, and she ran her fingers through it. He had hardly realized what she was doing. He had hardly taken in that she was kicking off shoes, stripping off pale, wet, mud-splashed tights, before she stood up and peeled the dress over her head. She stood there looking at him, her arms hanging by her sides. The room was too small for two people in it ever to be separated by more than a few feet. As it was, he found himself at no more than arm's length from this naked girl, whose strange, thin, big-breasted body was marble white, with, at the base of her flat belly, a triangle, not of silver or blonde, but of flame red. Philip was in no doubt, whatever he may have felt 30 seconds before, of what was going on and what she intended. She was eyeing him with that intense yet mysterious gaze with which she had so frequently favoured him at the wedding. He took a step towards her, put out his arms and held her shoulders with his hands. The coldness of marble was what he had strangely expected, but she was warm, hot even, her skin silky and dry. Philip folded her slowly in his arms, savouring the slippery, soft, full and slender nakedness against his own body. As she moved her head to bring her mouth against his, the long wet hair slapped at his hands, making him shiver. She whispered to him as her tongue flickered, her hands unbuttoning his shirt. "Into bed. I'm cold. I'm cold." But she felt as hot as a body on a tropical beach. The heat shimmered from her. It warmed the cold sheets. Philip pulled the duvet over them, and they lay pressed into each other's bodies in the narrow little bed. The rain began crashing against the window. Suddenly she started to make love to him with a greedy passion. Her fingers dug into his neck, his shoulders. She moved down his body, kissing his flesh, licking him with a curious gasping savour. Bowed over him, arching up the quilt, she swept him with her curtain of hair, teased him with her tongue. Her lips felt tender and rapturous and gentle. He gasped, "No," and then, "No," because it was too much. It stretched him to explosion point. Behind his head and inside his eyes was a red rolling light. Groaning, he pulled her onto him and entered her, her white body, now streaming with sweat, sinking onto his with a strange, quivering rhythm. She held him in a total clutch, holding her breath, then relaxing as she expelled it, drawing breath again, gripping him, releasing himself and her with a final expulsion and a little, thin scream. Her silver hair, which draped his shoulders, hung like the rain he could see falling straight and glittering beyond the glass. He felt a deep, extraordinary, profound satisfaction, as if he had found something he had always been searching for and found it finer than he expected. There were things he thought he ought to say, but all that came to mind was, "Thank you. Thank you." And he sensed that to utter this aloud would be wrong. Instead, he took her face in his hand and turned it to his and kissed her mouth long and very gently. She hadn't spoken a word since saying she was cold, and they should go to bed. But now she raised her head and laid it on the arm which held her. She took his right hand in her left one, interlocking their fingers. In that high, pure tone of hers, she said, "Philip." She uttered his name reflectively, as if she were listening to the sound of it, as if she were putting it to the test to see if she liked it.
"Philip."
He smiled at her. Her eyes were close to his, her mouth as close to his face as it could be without their lips touching. He saw every detail of its soft and tender curves, the sweetly tucked-in corners of it.
"Say my name," she said.
"Senta."
"It's a beautiful name, Senta." "Listen to me, Philip. When I saw you this morning, I knew at once that you were the one. I knew you were the only one."
Her tone was deeply solemn. She had raised herself on one elbow. She was looking deeply into his eyes.
"I saw you across the room, and I knew you were the one for me, for always."
He was astonished. This was not at all what he'd expected from her.
"I've been looking for you for a long, long time," she said. "And now I've found you, and it's wonderful."
Her intensity had begun slightly to embarrass him. He could only handle this awkwardness by speaking lightly, almost facetiously.
"Why, it can't be all that long.
How old are you, Senta? Not more than 20, are you?"
"I'm 24. You see, I'm going to tell you everything. I'll keep nothing from you. You can ask me anything."
He didn't particularly want to ask her things, just to hold her and feel her and have this glorious pleasure.
"I've been looking for you since I was 16. You see, I've always known there was just one man in the world for me, and I knew that when I saw him, I'd know."
Her lips brushed his shoulder. She turned her face and printed a kiss where the muscles swelled beyond the collarbone.
"I believe that souls come in pairs, Philip, but when we're born, they're split in two, and we spend all our lives trying to find our other half. But sometimes people make a mistake and get the wrong one."
"Well, this isn't a mistake, is it? It wasn't for me."
"This," she said, "is forever. Don't you feel that? I saw you across the room, and I knew you were the twin to my soul, the other half. That's why the first thing I ever said to you, the first word I spoke, was your name."
Philip thought he remembered the first word she had spoken was to say Hardy was a peculiar dog. But he must be mistaken. What did it matter, anyway? She was in his bed, had made love with him more gloriously than any girl ever before, and would do so almost certainly again.
"Forever,"
she whispered, a slow, hieratic smile spreading across her face. He was glad of that smile, for he didn't want her becoming too serious.
"Philip, I don't want you to say you love me. Not yet. I shan't tell you I love you, though I do. Those words are so commonplace, everyone uses them. They're not for us. What we have, and are going to have, is too deep for that. Our feelings are too deep."
She turned her face into the hollow of his shoulder and ran her fingers lightly down the length of his body, quickly exciting him again.
"Philip, shall I stay the night here with you?"
He hated having to refuse that. Christine wouldn't come into his room that night, but she would in the morning. She always did, bearing with her the cup of tea slopped into its saucer, the encrusted sugar bowl with the damp spoon stuck in it. She wouldn't criticize him. She might not even mention that she found him with a girl in his bed. She might only look dismayed and terribly embarrassed, her eyes wide and her hand going up to her pursed lips. But he wouldn't be able to bear it. It would be too much for him.
"I'd love you to, more than anything, but I don't really think it's on."
Without yet knowing her very well, he anticipated an immediate scene, fury perhaps, or tears. She surprised him by her radiant smile, the way she took his face in her hands and planted a tiny light kiss on his mouth. In a moment she was out of bed, shaking her hair, drawing her fingers through it.
"Doesn't matter. We can go to my place."
"You've a place of your own?"
"Of course. It's yours as well now, Philip. You understand that, don't you? It's yours as well."
In Cheryl's room, absent for an instant, she changed into the clothes she must have arrived in that morning. A long, full black skirt. A long, loose sweater of silvery knitted stuff the colour of her hair. These garments hid the shape of her as nearly as the burqa hides the contours of the Islamic woman. Her slender legs, tiny ankles, were in black tights, her feet in flat black pumps. She came back into his room and saw Flora in the corner for the first time.
"She looks like me."
He remembered what he had thought in Arnhem's garden before he stole her. If he ever met a girl like her, he would fall at once in love. His eyes went from centre to the statue, and he saw the resemblance. So often when you thought someone looked like someone else, or like a picture, say, the likeness disappeared when they were together. This didn't happen. They were twins, in stone and flesh. It made him shiver a little, as if something solemn had happened. "Yes, she looked like you." He realized he had spoken quite gravely. "I'll tell you about her sometime," he said.
"Yes, you must. I want to know all about you, Philip. I want to know everything. We must have no secrets from each other. Get dressed and come with me now. I'm scared of seeing other people. Oh, your mother, your sister, I don't know. I just don't want to meet anyone else. I think our first evening should be sacred somehow, don't you?"
The rain lifted for them just before they left, and when they came out into the streaming street, the setting sun showed. The sun made all the puddles and sheets of water shine like a paving of gold. She had hesitated a little before leaving the house, as if to go out was to take some kind of plunge. Perhaps it was, for the street was like a shallow riverbed. Once inside the car, she drew in her breath and sighed as if with relief, or perhaps just with happiness. He sat beside her, and they kissed.